Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 151 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm or download the MP3 after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast aggregators. You can listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You'll be responsible for any long-distance charges. Remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you'd like to sponsor the show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. You can donate via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or go to infectiousmyth.com/donate.php. If you want to make monthly donations, please go to patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Even a few dollars a month helps. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you would like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you listening, commenting, and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Speaking of donations, thanks to Annette for a one-time donation via PayPal. I appreciate it. Oh, we got some feedback on episode 149, which was an interview with Charles Ortel, who was a gay writer dating back to the 1980s, the publisher of New York Native, which for a time was one of the most prominent gay publications in New York City, until it ran smack into a wall of pharmaceutical opposition. Minya on Facebook wrote, "I haven't listened to your new episode yet, but I will. I just listened to your show last week with Charles Ortleb, which was episode 149, which was fascinating. I was a young teen when this happened and living in a southern small town, so the discussion of HIV/AIDS was almost nil until the story about the young boy in North Florida, Ryan White, occurred. It was tragic. Everything around this issue is tragic. And I found the idea about racism and diagnosis interesting. Thank you for your dedication to your show. Gift to come your way. Thanks in advance, Mindy." Lawrence wrote via email, "Thank you for an interesting conversation. After reading Brian Ellison's Why We Will Never Win the War on AIDS, Janine Roberts' Fear of the Invisible, and Dissolving Illusions by Suzanne Humphreys and Roman Bistrianic, who I've interviewed on this show, I'm not ready to go down another This Is Caused by a Virus road. I do agree that it's past time to take a fresh look at the situation. It is time we started thinking for ourselves, even if we disagree. I had not made an AIDS connection with chronic fatigue syndrome before. I'm not even sure there is a strong connection, but I have noticed many gay men who are depressed and have been for many years now. Being depressed, my guess, is that it's easier to accept an HIV-positive declaration without a fight. From what I can understand with my conversation with friends who are said to be HIV-positive, they know they have something. It's better to believe that it's HIV than to have something and not know what it is. This isn't the situation for everyone who is HIV-positive, and of course, this is not an issue that's unique to gay men." He then sent me to an episode of The Golden Girls, which is always funny, an episode called Sick and Tired, which I suspect has a lot to do with illness in the 80s or 90s. I responded to him. I don't remember exactly what I wrote, but basically my observation is that gay men have been dealing with two main issues. One is the whole, and this is true of gay women as well, the whole psychological load of being shunned by society, of discovering when you're fairly young that you're attracted to the same sex, not the opposite sex, and you know at that age that you have to hide it, that you will be shunned. things have improved a lot, but there are still many people in the world who believe that homosexuality is a disease, that people need to be shunned, punished, or even executed in some countries. Another problem that gay men dealt with, especially around the time of the AIDS epidemic, was a lot of drug use, which may have been connected to these psychological issues. And in particular, the abuse of poppers, which is an inhalant drug, which is almost entirely used by the gay community. And if you go online and look for poppers advertising, it's pretty easy to see the homoeroticism behind the names and labels that are used on bottles that really all contain the same chemical. Poppers are immunosuppressive and carcinogenic, and the first two AIDS diseases were PCP pneumonia, an infection due to immune suppression, and Kaposi's sarcoma, a cancer. But that was way too obvious to be accepted as a theory by an organization like the CDC that only accepts viruses or bacteria or genes as the causes of disease. Well, not entirely, but that's their preference. They certainly don't want to look at an environmental cause unless they're forced into it, or there's absolutely no other explanation that can involve one of the things they really like. I think I've had a pretty productive spring and early summer. Not only did I develop a paper and presentation for the legal conference on HIV criminalization that I discussed in the last episode, but I'm proud to say that I recently had a peer-reviewed medical article published on an Ebola vaccine. In fact, my article was on the only Ebola vaccine that's likely to be commercialized. The paper that I was critiquing was rather cumbersomely titled, Efficacy and Effectiveness of an RVSV-Vectored Vaccine in Preventing Ebola Virus Disease, Final Results from the Guinea Ring Vaccination Open-Label Cluster Randomized Trial, with the cute name Ebola Ça Suffit, which translates roughly from French to English as Ebola, that's enough, which is kind of what a frustrated mother or father might say to their child, that's enough. It was published in the December 22nd, 2016 issue of The Lancet, one of the top medical journals in the world. The Lancet and British Medical Journal from the UK, Journal of the American Medical Association, and the New England Journal of Medicine from the US, perhaps along with Nature and Science, are the most prestigious medical journals by far. The last two are general science journals, it's true, but getting a medical article published there has the same weight. Robert Gallo, for example, published four papers in the main 1984 issue of the journal Science, and that was all it took to have the HIV theory take the world by storm, despite the investigations that followed revealing that much in those papers was exaggerated, stolen, unreliable, or meaningless, possibly even fraudulent. And not only was this article on the Ebola vaccine, Ebola Ça Suffit, published in Lancet, but authors were from the World Health Organization, the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, Médecins Sans Frontières, and other famous infectious disease organizations and institutions. On the face of it, the paper was a perfect vaccine trial. If I gloss over a few details, nobody who got the vaccine got Ebola, and quite a few people who didn't get the vaccine got Ebola. Well, I guess I did gloss over a few details, a lot of details, which I'll get into in a little bit. This is a direct quote from the abstract that sums up the author's opinions about their wonderful findings. Quote, no cases of Ebola virus disease occurred 10 days or more after randomization among randomly assigned contacts and contacts of contacts vaccinated in immediate clusters versus 16 cases, 7 clusters affected, among all eligible individuals in delayed clusters. Vaccine efficacy was 100%. I'll explain some of the terminology as I go along, such as randomization, clusters, immediate, and deferred, in a little bit, but the money quote is, vaccine efficacy was 100%. You can't get better than that. At least you can't make a stronger claim. But I had a lot of concerns about this when I first read it, and I took those concerns to Lancet, hoping that they would publish a letter, because I considered and still do that what I'd found was fatal to the vaccine trial. In other words, the vaccine was not useless, but worse than useless. Not only did it not reduce the amount of Ebola, it might have increased it, as well as causing other side effects. So now you're going, whoa, first you tell me it's a perfect trial, and now you're telling me the opposite. What's going on? Well, Like many scientific papers, the dirt is published but hidden in plain sight. A lot of papers nowadays contain what's known as supplementary data. It's on the journal website, not published in the paper edition. And even if people read the article on the journal website, they tend not to read the supplementary data. But I did. Even without the supplementary data, there were a lot of concerns, but most of them were buried in the supplementary data. Why does this matter? Why am I so enthralled with critiquing an Ebola vaccine trial? Well, it does appear to be the only vaccine that's going to be commercialized, but more than that, it calls the whole Ebola disease model into question. You'll understand why in a little bit. If the Ebola vaccine is not effective, it will divert attention away from more effective interventions. And of course, the same is true if Ebola is not really an infectious condition, but it's really rebranding conditions caused by poverty, lack of clean water, lack of nutrition, etc., rebranding them as an infectious disease when they're really environmental. An Ebola vaccine is going to distract attention from all of that. And if it's worse than ineffective, i.e. it causes more disease, whether that's Ebola-like disease or if it's side effects of the vaccine, then clearly it's a public health disaster waiting to happen. If you vaccinate 10 or 100 million people, people are going to die. People are going to be injured with effects lasting for the rest of their world. Even if the vast majority of people have no side effects from the vaccine at all, the burden of the few who have tremendous side effects will be more than Africa can afford. Well, what did the journal Lancet do when they got my letter? Well, they rejected it without explaining why. I also wrote several times to the lead author who works for the World Health Organization. She at first didn't respond, and then in the only email she sent me, she told me she was far too busy. Just so that I don't mischaracterize her email, here it is. Dear David, many thanks again for your interest in our work. My current heavy workload doesn't allow me to enter into regular exchanges with the many stakeholders who see this trial as a source of inspiration. I am again on duty travel. The responses to all your questions are provided in the three articles we have published or their web annexes, which is, in translation, this is how scientists say, F off and die. I especially like how she's even too busy to write to her fans, those who find a source of inspiration, let alone somebody who has critical questions and concerns. I even identified blatant errors, places where numbers didn't add up, just obviously wrong. But her first-class seat to save the poor people in Africa is calling. So I turned to the American Journal of Immunology, a peer-reviewed medical journal, which published my article online, and I guess it will be in the paper edition sometime in the near future. And now I'd like to go through it with you. I will post the link to my article online along with a link to the Lancet article. Both of them are freely available, so I encourage you to read and review both of them. If you have any concerns about either of them, let me know, especially if you find a flaw in my logic. So this is going to be the audiobook version of my scientific paper. I'll read it and pause when I think more explanation is required. It does get a bit complicated in places, but I don't think that's my fault. I think the vaccine researchers were able to hide a lot of the flaws in the trial by making it unnecessarily complicated. So, deep breath, here we go. A paper published in 2016 announced highly positive results for an Ebola virus vaccine with no infections in people vaccinated after the vaccine had time to take effect. This was widely acclaimed in the press, even after only interim results were published, which was in 2015, with headlines such as Ebola vaccine trial proves 100% successful in Guinea, which was from The Guardian. This vaccine, once fully commercialized, could be offered to tens or hundreds of millions of Africans. If safe and effective, it could reduce the scourge of Ebola epidemics, but if not, it could add the cost of adverse reactions to the vaccine to an unchanged burden of Ebola outbreaks and discourage other responses to Ebola prevention. When Ebola hemorrhagic fever was described and named in the 1970s, it was a deadly and horrifying hemorrhagic fever. People had blood coming out of their eyes, their ears, their noses, their anus. It was blood everywhere. It truly was horrible. It was first found near the river it was named after, the Ebola River. But current definitions no longer require bleeding, and it appears that this is now a relatively rare symptom. I cited a paper where they analyzed the symptoms of Ebola in a large number of people, not in Guinea where this vaccine trial occurred, but in another country. And they found only one person had any symptoms of bleeding. Bleeding has even been removed from the name of the disease, which is now called Ebola virus disease, or EVD. The result of this trial that was most prominent in the Lancet article and in media articles was that no cases of Ebola were diagnosed in vaccinated participants more than 10 days after randomization, which I'll get into later is slightly different than vaccination. However, this 10-day period is arbitrary, ignores the widely cited 2 to 21-day incubation period, which ironically comes from the World Health Organization, and avoids consideration that overall there were significantly more Ebola cases in the two vaccinated subgroups than in some unvaccinated subgroups, a result for which no explanation was provided. Perhaps due to the desire to test the vaccine before the Ebola epidemic waned, an unusual and obviously deficient trial design was used without a placebo, with only partial randomization, and without blinding to either participants or trial workers. Let me discuss those terms a little bit. So a placebo basically means that you give something that's indistinguishable from the active ingredient. For example, you could inject saline instead of the vaccine. That would be a reasonable placebo for a vaccine. Randomization means that you take every person who comes into the trial, every person you're going to vaccinate, and you decide whether they're going to get the vaccine or the placebo randomly. And it has nothing to do with whether they're in a group with other people or not, whether they're in the same village or not. Every person is treated separately and gets a random number and either goes left or right, vaccine or placebo. That's the randomization. And the blinding basically means that the people getting vaccinated don't know if they're getting vaccinated or not, which requires the placebo. They can't tell the difference. They're injected with something. They don't know if it's the vaccine or the placebo. But it's also important that trial workers are also blinded, and that's why they talk about double blinding. So the participants in the trial are blinded, they don't know what they're getting, and the trial workers don't know what they're giving. Now, somebody in an office somewhere has the secret codes. So for the random number that's placed on the vial that tells, somebody knows whether that's vaccine or placebo. So later in the trial, they will, as they say, unblind the trial, and they will associate the random numbers with this was vaccine, this was placebo, then they can do their analysis. But it's really important that that information is kept to a very small group. Sometimes, for example, the manufacturer of a drug or a vaccine will provide that service. They will put code numbers, and half the vials will be one thing and half will be another. Okay, so returning to my paper. The trial also recorded little baseline information, which is information of the participants before anything happened in the trial. Essentially, no socioeconomic or health data, so the comparability of the groups cannot be properly assessed. This is particularly important for a trial which is not double-blinded, not randomized, not properly randomized, and not placebo-controlled. An important missing piece of baseline data is an Ebola test on each participant, which is needed because high rates of false positives have been found in some studies of Ebola tests. For example, up to 15 or 20% of people have tested positive in places where there was no Ebola epidemic, and the people being tested had no symptoms of Ebola. Combine this with a similarity between Ebola symptoms and adverse events in this trial that were not classified as Ebola, the possibility of misclassification of vaccine side effects as Ebola or vice versa is immense. So in this trial, there is some terminology you need to know. They had three arms of the trial. It basically means three different groups of people. It was either immediate, delayed, or unrandomized. Immediate basically means that at the beginning of the trial, people were vaccinated. Delayed means that people were called in, and they were told that they'd be called back in 20 days and vaccinated after 21 days. Nothing happened to them on that first day except that they were asked if they'd like to be part of the trial. Unrandomized means that later in the trial, they took some people and they vaccinated them right away, but they had no comparable group. They had no delayed or placebo group in that time. So let's talk about the trial design. Clearly, this trial design was not optimal. Not blinded, let alone double blinded, no placebo, and it was only partially randomized. And these deficiencies have been known for a long time to affect outcomes in favor of the intervention. In other words, if you don't do these things, you're more likely to conclude that what you're testing is it has a positive impact. I quoted a paper from 1989 saying that these things are problems. Instead of a placebo, the trial was divided into immediate and delayed. As I said, the immediate group were vaccinated shortly after randomization, and I'll describe what randomization was in a little bit. And in the latter arm, they were vaccinated approximately 21 days later. Because of this design, blinding was impossible, because the people who were called in on day one and then vaccinated on day 21 obviously knew what was happening, just as the people, since everybody, any injection was a vaccine, the other people knew that they'd been vaccinated on day one. They intended, obviously, that the delayed arm was going to substitute for a placebo, because the people in this arm could be observed for 21 days without vaccination. And then they felt, obviously, ethically, these people deserved the vaccine. So after 21 days, they would vaccinate them and then observe them for another 10 days. So, but unfortunately, the people were aware of the fact they were not vaccinated and wouldn't be until 21 days later. And they were vaccinated 10 days before the end of the trial, and they were keeping statistics on things like adverse events throughout the whole 31 days. So they don't really constitute a fully unvaccinated comparison group. And the data for these last 10 days is not properly segregated, it's not separately analyzed. When it comes to randomization, the trial was what they called cluster randomized. There were 117 cases of Ebola that were selected as the basis for a new cluster. And all of that patient's contacts, people they knew, worked with, whatever, and contacts of their contacts were enrolled in the same randomly chosen cluster. And this was an average of 80 people in the immediate group, 81 in the delayed group, and 105 in the unrandomized groups. So what that means is one person would get Ebola who was actually not analyzed as part of the trial, and everybody connected to them, an average of 80 to 100 people, would be thrown into the same cluster. And either all those people would be immediately vaccinated, or they would get delayed vaccination as a group. So there were over 9,000 people in this trial, but statistically the sample size is 98, which is the number of clusters. And another problem with randomization was that 4 months into the trial, they said this trial seems to be working, so everybody who comes along is going to get immediately vaccinated. And then they analyzed that information. It would be fine to say the trial's been successful, we promised we were going to vaccinate you, we're going to vaccinate you, but we're not going to analyze your data because we're violating trial protocol, but they went ahead and included them. So regarding baseline information, this means the information that you take on people who are going to participate in the trial before they actually do anything, before they're injected or anything like that. And so there were some tremendous differences in the very little amount of baseline data they got. For example, in the unrandomized group, 4 months into the trial, they decided they were going to include children. So the median age of that group is obviously much younger than in the first two groups. And even though the median ages in the immediate and delayed groups were different, the spread of ages was quite different. They recorded gender, obviously, and in the immediate group, it was 53%, but in the delayed group, it was 66%, and the unrandomized group, 63%. So that's an indication that these clusters were not totally comparable, because it's a pretty significant difference between 53% and 66% female. The index cases were the people with Ebola disease who were used to start a cluster, and more of those in the delayed group were dead at the time of randomization. In other words, they would be told there's an Ebola case. They would go and find the person's contacts, but by the time they went to see this person, they were already dead. That implies that they had a more severe form of Ebola, and more of those were in the delayed than in either the immediate or the unrandomized groups. And also, with the unrandomized groups that came later in the trial, many fewer were in rural areas, so they were obviously concentrating on city dwellers. It was about 3/4 of the immediate and delayed groups were in rural areas, but only less than 50% in the unrandomized groups. So these are important because it indicates that you're comparing the number of Ebola cases, et cetera, in these groups. But if the composition of the groups is not the same, it damages the credibility of the conclusions that you can draw. Perhaps more important is the baseline data that was collected for the actual participants in the study. So if you're not getting too confused by now, you have a cluster that's created by one person who actually has Ebola, and then you have an average of 80 to 100 people who are contacts with that person or contacts of contacts. And they also analyzed a little bit of baseline data for those people. Not very much. There was no socioeconomic data. For example, what was the person's income level? Did they finish high school or college? Did they live in a house with running water? Those kinds of things that tell you a lot about people's personal circumstances. Are they living in poverty or in relative comfort? A couple of things that they discovered was that in this group, people had the right to refuse to get the vaccine. And amongst those who consented were a much smaller percentage of women. So women were much more likely to say no to the vaccine. So that means that the group of people who were actually vaccinated is different than the people who were actually put into the cluster. And all the analysis was on everybody in the cluster. And in some cases, a large number of people in the cluster refused vaccination. For example, in the delayed group, those who consented when they were first met on what they called day zero, there were 1,435 people, but only 940 of those were actually vaccinated. But the data that was presented was for all 1,435. Now, it is important to collect data for everybody, but it's also important to present the data also for the subgroup who were actually vaccinated. You could think that there would be a strong correlation between baseline socioeconomic and health characteristics of an index case and the members of the cluster. So, for example, if the initiator of a cluster, a person with Ebola, is poor, it's probably more likely that more of their contacts will be poor. If the person is a woman, it may be more likely that their contacts and contacts of contacts are more heavily represented by women. If they're in a rural area, probably their contacts and contacts of contacts are more likely to be rural. But there was no such information presented. As I mentioned before, there was no Ebola test taken at baseline for everybody in the cluster, which is very important because of the high rate of false positives. When it came to consent, so this is, people had the option to say, I will accept the vaccine or not. The immediate group were presented with, we're doing a vaccine trial, do you consent to being vaccinated or not? And if they consented, they were vaccinated almost immediately. There was a delay of between 2 and 3 days, but it was very quick. But in the delayed group, they were asked on day zero, and they were asked again on day 21. So you had people who agreed on day zero and then withdrew consent on day 21, people who didn't consent on day zero, but they were asked again on day 21, and they did consent. So there were actually four groups of people in the delayed case in terms of consent. So this further could exaggerate the differences between the immediate and delayed groups. And as I just mentioned, they didn't analyze the data for those who were vaccinated. They just analyzed the data for everybody in the cluster. So if there's further segregation of people because whether they consented or not, like we do know, for example, that a much lower percentage of women consented. So obviously the the actual vaccinated group contained more men as opposed to the original cluster. But there was no other information that was collected on this, so we really don't know how comparable are the groups that were actually vaccinated, the immediate vaccinated and the delayed vaccinated group, as opposed to the overall group, which is a mixture of people who were vaccinated and those who refused. So there's this thing about 10 days. So if you were vaccinated and you came down with Ebola within the first 10 days, That was not considered due to the vaccine. This was because, for example, Ebola has an incubation period of several days. Therefore, you might have been infected before you were vaccinated and you still got sick, but it wasn't because the vaccine didn't work. There's a time between the onset of symptoms and diagnosis. Like you might have a bit of a flu or something, and it's later that somebody diagnoses you with Ebola. And then there's also the fact that vaccines are not believed to take effect immediately, but to take some time. So let's say that it did take 10 days, then you couldn't blame the vaccine for Ebola that occurred before those 10 days. However, if you have a comparison group, you shouldn't need to do anything complicated like this, because you have a placebo group who are vaccinated with saline solution at the same time. And then you can compare the numbers of cases of Ebola in those two groups. So, for example, if the group injected with saline has a higher number of Ebola cases in those first days, perhaps the vaccine is taking effect earlier than you thought. So it could actually be good for the vaccine. It's a very simple way to know whether what you're seeing is potentially due to the vaccine or not, within the limits of a statistical analysis. And the 10-day period is completely arbitrary, because the World Health Organization itself has said that the incubation period is between 2 days and 21 days. So that means, basically, they believe that some people, when infected on day zero, will get sick on day two, and some on day 21. So a 10-day period is completely meaningless. And the results could actually be better or worse for the vaccine. So it's a really poor trial design, as opposed to a proper placebo comparison group, where you can look at what happens, and if you're looking at vaccine side effects or you're looking at Ebola cases, you've got two comparable groups. The groupings, the periods of time got very complicated. The immediate and unrandomized groups had an exclusion period of 10 days at the beginning of the 31-day period. So in other words, they were injected just about at the beginning, and then they would start counting Ebola cases from day 10 to day 31. That's a 21-day period. Now, in the other group, they were unvaccinated for 21 days, and then they were vaccinated for 10 days before the end of the 31-day period. Now, that 10-day period is obviously comparable to the first 10 days of the immediate and unrandomized groups, yet they did not compare these groups. They compared the 10-day exclusion period, what I'm calling an exclusion period, between the time people were vaccinated and when they were expected to have an effective vaccine. They compared that to the first 10 days of the delayed group, in which nothing happened. So it's, again, an invalid comparison. But another thing this trial did, and this might be very significant, is that at the end of 31 days, which is a very short period of time, they, quote, censored the rest of the results. What that basically means is they didn't record any cases of Ebola that occurred more than 31 days after the beginning of the trial. So there's no proof that the vaccine protects anyone for more than 21 days. And it's possible that they actually detected cases of Ebola in vaccinated participants, but they occurred after the 31-day trial period, and so they just didn't talk about them. Another problem that can occur with vaccines is, of course, adverse events. And even the best proponents of vaccines admit that, yeah, you can get a sore arm, you can get a headache, you can get a fever. Those things are all part of your immune system reacting to the vaccine. They might deny that there is severe adverse effects, but they will admit that there are minor. They found a high rate of minor adverse effects in those who were vaccinated. Stunningly, they didn't report them for the delayed period. So what you should do in a comparison group, for example, if you inject on day zero, you inject half the people with a vaccine and half with saline solution, you should count all the headaches that occur in those vaccinated versus those with the placebo. And if you get 10 headaches in the vaccinated, you don't say the vaccine causes headaches. If you get approximately 10 headaches in the unvaccinated, you just say, well, we had the same number of headaches in both groups, so it's probable that headaches are not a side effect of this vaccine. But if you get 30 headaches in the vaccinated and 3 headaches in the in those injected with the placebo, then you start to say, okay, headaches are a side effect of this vaccine. So it's really highly irresponsible, incredible, really, that they just didn't report minor side effects for the delayed. So they have no comparison group. So they listed, what were these side effects? Well, in one reporting period after vaccination, they found that 27, almost 28% of vaccine recipients reported a headache. 15.5% reported muscle pain. 15.1% reported arthralgia, which is joint pain, and 14.5% reported myalgia, which is also muscle pain. I don't know why they how they distinguish between muscle pain and myalgia. So these quite likely are vaccine side effects. They also had pain at the injection site in 6.4%, which again makes sense, would be a vaccine adverse reaction. Fatigue in 2.2%, and one case of induration, which is almost certainly a vaccine side effect, which is hardening of the area around the injection. But there was no reporting from the comparison group, so you can't really tell how many of these minor adverse effects were due to the vaccine and how many likely would have occurred anyway. There were 80 adverse events classified as serious and detailed in the supplementary information, which hardly anybody reads. And this included some deaths. Out of the 80 serious adverse events, the researchers declared only two definitely related to vaccination. One was a serious fever, and another was a serious allergic reaction, and one possibly, which was influenza-like symptoms. But serious adverse events were not reported for the unvaccinated, except for Ebola diagnoses and one road traffic accident, which presumably is not related to the vaccination unless the vaccine made the person dizzy, which caused the traffic accident, but let's assume it's not. So again, by not reporting adverse events, serious adverse events in the comparison group, you really can't say that out of the 80 adverse events that were serious, 77 were not related to the vaccine. That's completely arbitrary and unscientific. Now for what might be the most incredible part of this vaccine trial, which is to compare side effects to the symptoms of Ebola. So they didn't report the definition of Ebola that they used in the Lancet paper. However, let's look at the Centers for Disease Control definition from 2014. It basically has three criteria for a confirmed Ebola case. One symptom, and they give a list, which I'll get into in a second. An epidemiological risk factor, that means contact with somebody else with Ebola, contact with Ebola contaminated materials, working in a lab where Ebola is present, et cetera, et cetera. And the third is a positive Ebola test. The CDC's lists of symptoms for Ebola are elevated body temperature or subjective fever, or other symptoms including severe headache, fatigue, muscle pain, vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pain, or unexplained hemorrhage bleeding. So we can enumerate this list as 1, fever, 2, severe headache, 3, fatigue, 4, muscle pain, 5, vomiting, 6, diarrhea, 7, abdominal pain, and 8, unexplained hemorrhage. And I found another CDC document from 2015 called the Evaluation Algorithm, and it talked about headache but didn't say it had to be severe, and didn't require that hemorrhage was unexplained, and adds a 9th symptom of weakness. So pretty much the same thing. This is what's stunning. There's a significant overlap between his Ebola symptoms and the most frequent adverse events listed in the trial. So I presented in the paper, I presented a table combining the child and adult data from the Lancet study. And what did we find? So CDC Ebola symptom of fever, there were 14 adverse events counted in the trial. Headache is a CDC Ebola symptom. There were 1,832 adverse events counted in the trial. Fatigue is a CDC Ebola symptom. There were 1,361 events. Muscle pain is a CDC Ebola symptom. And if we combine muscle pain and myalgia, we have 1,816 symptoms. The other symptoms of Ebola, vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pain, hemorrhage, and weakness were at much lower levels. And the adverse events that were not possibly Ebola symptoms were at a much lower number. There were 937 cases of joint pain arthralgia, the one of induration, 449 of injection pain, and 706 unspecified, which we'll just assume are not Ebola symptoms. So the CDC definition requires a symptom, so we have a large number of adverse events that could be Ebola symptoms. So now the question is, what's the second thing that we need, which is an epidemiological connection? But because of the nature of the trial, that everybody was enrolled in the trial because they were either a contact of somebody with Ebola or a contact of a contact, it's likely that the epidemiological risk factor could be satisfied for the majority of people in this trial. So then the only other thing we've got left is a positive Ebola test, but we already know that up to 15 or 20% of healthy people who are tested for Ebola will test positive, at least on some tests. Therefore, the only way to really know whether somebody came down with Ebola during the trial is to take an Ebola test at the beginning of the trial to see whether they have an asymptomatic case. Most people don't believe that such cases exist, but if you're testing people in an area without Ebola and you're getting 15% testing positive, then obviously you either have 15% rate of false positives or 15% rate of Ebola infections without symptoms. And it doesn't really matter. It still means that at the beginning of the trial, you need to have an Ebola test. And so then, if somebody tests positive at the beginning of the trial, they don't enter the trial because you're trying to see whether this person becomes Ebola positive. So now you have this interesting situation where in the Lancet paper, they classified some symptoms as adverse events, such as, for example, there was 1,832 headaches as an adverse events, and others, they must have classified the same symptoms as Ebola. And they knew who was vaccinated and who was not. So if they preferentially diagnosed those who were vaccinated with vaccine adverse events and preferentially diagnosed those who weren't vaccinated, or at least not at that time, as Ebola, they could significantly bias the trial. This alone could completely destroy the results of this trial. Let's look at the cases of Ebola in those who were vaccinated. Now, if you weren't listening carefully at the beginning, you might have thought that there were no cases of Ebola following vaccination. That's not true. There was this 10-day period during which cases of Ebola did not count against the vaccine. So there were 25 cases. There were 25 cases of Ebola that occurred after vaccination, all before 10 days. But six occurred on the same day as vaccination, three the day after, or seven the following day. So more than half of the cases of Ebola that occurred after vaccination occurred on day zero, one, or two. What's the chance that somebody would suddenly develop the symptoms of Ebola the same day they were vaccinated? It would seem to be virtually zero, even in a place where there was a lot of Ebola, and as we'll find out later, there wasn't actually a lot of Ebola in Guinea. So were these just vaccine side effects that were diagnosed as Ebola? Because you could do that in the first 10 days and you would know that it wouldn't be a negative for the vaccine. So let's look at all 105 cases of Ebola in the trial, some among people who were vaccinated, some among those who weren't. So if we look at the rate of Ebola among those vaccinated in the immediate group, it was 0.165 cases per day per 1,000 people. Don't let the number confuse you. We'll just use the comparable number, 0.165. Remember that number. Amongst those in the same group who did not consent, the rate of Ebola was 0.477. So this is compatible with the vaccine working. There's like a 3 to 4 times more cases of Ebola amongst those who didn't get vaccinated, even though they were in the immediate group, because they refused or they didn't show up or something else went wrong and they didn't get vaccinated. But in the unrandomized group, the rate among those vaccinated was 0.192, a little bit higher than amongst immediate. But in those who didn't consent, the rate of Ebola was only about half of that, which is not evidence for the vaccine working, quite quite the opposite. In the delayed arm, those who consented on day zero had a rate of Ebola of 0.36, which is about double that amongst in the immediate group. They weren't vaccinated. But in the same group, those who didn't consent to be vaccinated on day 21 had a much higher rate, 1.158. So why would two groups of people who were not vaccinated have dramatically different rates of Ebola? Now there's a big surprise, because those who consented on day 21, so in other words, they said no on day zero, but they were brought back on day 21, and they said, okay, you can vaccinate me. They had a rate of 0.029. There was only a single case of Ebola amongst in the delayed group in those who consented on day 21, and it occurred after vaccination. So this was a much lower rate of Ebola in this group of people than in the people who were immediately vaccinated. So in conclusion, the overall rate of Ebola in those who were vaccinated in the immediate group and in the unrandomized group was much higher than the unvaccinated in the unrandomized group. It was about double. And particularly those in the delayed group who consented on day 21. And no statistics or other analysis was presented to help determine why these anomalies occur. So, in conclusion, the design of this trial deviated from the gold standard of double-blinded randomized placebo-controlled trials in important ways. The trial was not blinded at all, let alone double-blinded. It was cluster randomized, meaning that there were 98 randomizations instead of 9,000. One arm was completely unrandomized, which contained 2,745 participants. Instead of a placebo, some kind of mock vaccine, there was a group that simply was not vaccinated until after a 21-day observation period. The design, apart from its scientific flaws, results in a complex set of monitoring periods of different lengths, because even in the group that was vaccinated at the beginning, there was a 2 to 3 day delay between when they were randomized and when they were vaccinated, and the 10-day observation period was from randomization to 10 days. So the actual time when they were vaccinated before they started counting cases of Ebola against the vaccine was actually less than 10 days, which is actually favorable towards the vaccine. Even so, there were a lot of cases of Ebola in that approximately 8-day period. Comprehensive baseline data is always important, but even more so when a trial deviates from the recognized gold standard of a double-blinded, randomized, placebo-controlled trial. So you really can't compare the three trial arms, especially when you consider a large number of people who didn't consent to be vaccinated. And then they changed the rules in the trial where they added children into the unrandomized arm later into the trial and analyzed the data from those children. But there were some significant differences in the small amount of baseline data that was analyzed, enough to say that maybe the groups were not comparable. Another problem with the baseline data, that was it reported for the entire cluster. It wasn't reported for the subset who were vaccinated. And in some groups, a relatively small percentage were actually vaccinated. So they should have provided the data for both the overall group and also for those who were actually vaccinated. Critically important was the fact that there's been high rates of false positive Ebola tests. And also the fact that there's a wide variation in incubation periods of 2 to 21 days. So you can't really use an arbitrary 10-day period to eliminate Ebola cases that are not related to vaccination. You really need to have a comparison group, which this trial did not have. Between the immediate group and the delayed group had two chances to consent, which is going to further shift the parameters of this group. We don't know how it would shift them because those parameters were not measured, but you can say that if you give people two chances to consent, you're going to end up with a significantly different group than if people are given one chance and then vaccinated right away. Serious adverse events, except for 14 diagnoses of Ebola, were only reported for the immediately vaccinated groups. Again, this even damages further the comparability of the two groups. They could have compared serious adverse events in those people who were going to be delayed on day 21. They could have looked at bad things that happened to those people in the first 21 days to see whether the number of bad things that happened to people who hadn't had a medical intervention was similar to those who'd had a vaccine. But they didn't do that. Yet they managed to say that 77 out of 80 serious adverse events were not related to the vaccine, even though they didn't have a comparison group. The 10-day exclusion period, which I've already mentioned, was completely arbitrary. They used a fancy word, a priori, in the study to say they basically just randomly or arbitrarily decided that it would be a 10-day period. Obviously, even based on the World Health Organization's own research, where they say that the period from infection to symptoms is 2 to 21 days, a 10-day period doesn't make sense. And they could have avoided that completely if they'd had a proper comparison group. So it's a big problem with the proper comparison group, the lack of a proper comparison group. Another problem with this 10-day period is that it is most comparable to the days 21 to 31 amongst those who were vaccinated on day 21. It's the first 10 days after vaccination. But they didn't compare those two periods. They compared the 10 days in the immediate group, the first 10 days, to the first 10 days in the deferred group, even though those are not comparable time periods. Another flaw in the trial was that the 10-day period was not the period from vaccination to 10 days, but it was the period from randomization. And there was actually a period of, as I said earlier, 2 to 3 days between when people were randomized and when they were actually vaccinated. So the actual 10-day exclusion period was actually only 7 to 8 days. So that's a pretty significant reduction. If the 10-day period was some magic number, then it's not 10 days. To me, the biggest surprise in the trial was the overlap between common adverse events of vaccines and symptoms of Ebola: headache, fatigue, muscle pain. And as I said, because the trial was not blinded, the people in the trial knew who'd been vaccinated or not, so you could preferentially diagnose Ebola amongst those unvaccinated during the first 10 days, and then you could diagnose it as an adverse event afterwards. And you could preferentially diagnose people who weren't vaccinated with Ebola. They did mention that the diagnosis of Ebola was performed by an external laboratory that didn't know whether or not the person had been vaccinated or not. But that's not really the point. The decision to send the sample to the lab when you have a potential of a 15 to 20% false positive rate is what biases the trial. So they needed a baseline Ebola test. Everybody should have had an Ebola test on day zero, and everybody who tested positive should have been eliminated from the trial, because obviously you cannot tell from those people whether they've become infected or not if they're already positive at the beginning. The best outcome of this trial was that there were no cases of Ebola among the vaccinated after this arbitrary 10-day exclusion period, but they didn't really mention that there were two subgroups of unvaccinated people they reported on in the supplementary data that had a much lower overall rate of Ebola diagnosis over the entire 31 days. And there was no attempt to explain, they just didn't talk about it. Why, for example, is the number of Ebola cases are amongst those who consented at the very, very beginning in the delayed group 40 times higher than amongst those who consented on day 21? That makes no sense. So there are reasons to want to cut scientific corners, such as in this trial. Sometimes there are ethical justifications, but commentators on this trial said that the decisions made in this trial were, quote, pragmatic. So basically they wanted to quickly prove out a vaccine because Ebola epidemics have been known to hit quickly and then decline quickly. So they wanted to strike while the iron was hot, and they wanted to do this trial at a time when there would be cases of Ebola that they could then use to say that the vaccine was effective. But scientific principles of clinical trials were not just put in by bureaucrats to be awkward. They were put in to reduce the danger of approving treatments that would later be found ineffective or dangerous or both. A quick trial that's scientifically invalid, approving a vaccine, one would hope is not more important than ensuring that a vaccine is truly safe and effective. If people believe that there's a safe and effective Ebola vaccine, it will obviously have a huge impact on policy. Everybody will be running around Africa vaccinating everybody, and they will be paying no attention to anything else that could be related to Ebola. Even if you believe the entire Ebola infectious theory, it's quite likely that poverty, unclean drinking water, poor nutrition, things like that, make it more likely that you will come down with these symptoms. Nobody's going to be looking at putting in clean water symptoms because everybody's going to be running around with a needle sticking into people with a vaccine. A valid clinical trial should be double-blinded, randomized, and placebo-controlled with adequate baseline data gathered to confirm the randomization. And in this case, the baseline data should include an Ebola test. And this is not just theoretical. There are huge differences between some groups in terms of the number of Ebola cases, which make absolutely no sense, indicate that these groups are not really comparable. The arbitrary 10-day period, which absolved the vaccine of responsibility for any Ebola cases, was arbitrary. And it didn't need to be used if there was a proper comparison group. And it disguises the fact that over the entire 31-day period, some unvaccinated groups, two large unvaccinated subgroups, had a much lower rate of Ebola than the two vaccinated subgroups. And symptoms of vaccine side effects and Ebola are very similar. Therefore, there's a huge possibility, a huge risk that they would preferentially diagnose side effects as Ebola or Ebola as side effects in a way that was beneficial to the trial. I concluded my paper by saying it may be that a proper scientific trial of an Ebola vaccine is impossible until the next Ebola epidemic, and everybody certainly wishes that this never happens. However, using an improperly trialed vaccine because it's, quote, better than nothing, may well not be better than nothing. Thank you for listening to episode 151 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter or Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Send me your comments, particularly on this episode of my work on the Ebola vaccine. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.